এক্ষণে আহিল। টকিং টু
Good evening, Volodymyr Ershenko, and welcome to Ex Nihilo. Both Martin and I found your use of Antonio Gramsci in your new book as an intellectual lens for examining the Ukrainian social conflicts that were already playing out before the Russian invasion most interesting.
You begin your excellent book very personally by placing us within your family's background, where your grandparents were the first generation to receive degrees in higher education and teach at the university level during the Soviet era's scientific materialism. However, this story also reflects the dark sides of the Soviet experience, as your grandmother was a survivor of the Holodomor, and your great grandfather was mistakenly executed as a Polish spy. But what we both liked most was reading how your parents, both engineers, met at Viktor Glushkov's Institute of Cybernetics, who is considered the founding father of Russian cybernetics, meaning they could be described as digital pioneers. This is an interesting reference pointing right to rupture in time, namely global digitalization, which not only changed Western societies, but also brought about the downfall of the Soviet Empire. I can still remember clearly when I moved to Berlin in the 1980s, how the rift between East and West grew ever wider, and how Erich Honecker publicly presented a fake 4-megabyte chip to prove his socialism's modernity. Do you think this could be the actual rift Francis Fukuyama mistakenly called the end of history?
Well, that's funny that as a digital native and as a son of the scientists and engineers at the Institute of Cybernetics, I remember not only this 4-megabyte floppy disks, but we actually had, my parents had on the balcony where they kept all the rubbish. In fact, the 5-inch diskettes, even 20 inches disks, and even the punch cards, those paper things, on which the very first computers worked. So these are kind of like memories from the childhood. And then, it's also interesting that our family got a personal computer quite late. I think in the end of the 1990s, my father got it from his job. So it was not even ours, but my father got it from the job, and sometimes he brought it to my home. And then when I was in the early 90s as a like teenager, I kind of like envied to my classmates who had this very early personal computers. Some of them were still Soviet, Poisk. Poisk means a search. And they were actually constructed in Kiev where some of the parents of my classmates worked. And then they've got IBMs. And we didn't have one. But yeah, we were kind of like, so the cultural elite or technical intelligentsia in the 1990s was could be kind of like poor and could not actually afford to buy a personal computer, at least in the post-Soviet Ukraine. So, yeah, that was a cultural or intellectual elite, but not the middle class, at least in the Western understanding of the appropriate living standards. So we haven't, our family haven't never got a personal automobile car. And so, yeah, but at the same time, as I start that book, my father was a graduate of the Moscow Institute of Physics and Technology, which was a highly prestigious and indeed a highly quality higher education institution in the whole Soviet Union, sometimes compared to the Massachusetts Institute of Technology as the like elite institution for the scientists. Those people who were actually moving forward the Soviet science and technology, and specifically the rocket science, the cosmonautics, where my father started his career. So yeah, but obviously this there was indeed a technological gap growing between the Soviet Union and the United States and some other highly developed Western countries and Eastern Japan in particular. And as many historians, they believe that actually this technological gap was the main reason for Gorbachev to start the reforms, which ended in perestroika, and then it ended in the collapse of the Soviet Union. There was like an objective reason for those reforms, because indeed the modernizing drive that was started by the Soviet Revolution in the 1920s, 1930s, it kind of like slowed down by 1970s, or maybe even earlier, when the rate of growth in the Soviet Union started to decline, and so a period of so-called stagnation started under Brezhnev. And one of the reasons was actually that the ruling communist elite, so-called nomenklatura, showed incapacity or even unwillingness to incorporate the younger generation of those people who were born after the Second World War and on the rise of more optimistic and more kind of like forward-looking expectations about the future. But basically the Communist Party failed to incorporate this 60s generation and rejuvenate both the party and also the ideology, and both all the institutions and ideologies that were becoming more and more rigid, ossified and more distant from the changing Soviet reality, which was not anymore the agrarian society, which was rapidly industrializing. It was already an urbanized, industrial, modern state, and it required significant political reform. So it's some of the most forward-looking Soviet reformers during Khrushchev's era, they were speaking about socialist democracy. There was a need to expand the reach to the society to include more and more people into the real decision making in the state, maybe even to limit the power of the party elite. That didn't happen for the variety of reasons, and what happened? Alexei Yurchak's now kind of like living classic of studying the late Soviet period, the book "It Was Forever Until No More." He explains and analyzes the late Soviet culture and the relation to the politics, a very kind of like distant one, and rather accepting it on the background and doing their own things, sometimes with the help of the communist ideology and institutions, sometimes kind of like outside of them, but the outcome was, what you mentioned, the end of history by Fukuyama, which was fundamentally the collapse of the counter-hegemonic alternatives to the dominant capitalism. Which does not actually mean that neoliberal capitalism became hegemonic in the proper understanding of the word hegemony, although that thousands of people are using this word, neoliberal hegemony. But it's actually doesn't look like that the richest fraction of the capitalist class has been capable for the moral, intellectual, and political leadership over subaltern classes in the processes of kind of like pumping the wealth from below to above. And now we see the escalating crisis on the multiple levels. And the collapse of the Soviet Union was one of the reasons which contributed to that, because that was the collapse of the most viable and the strongest alternative to capitalism. And we haven't got to to find other alternatives so far.
In your book, you mentioned that Soviet science fiction was crucial for developing your worldview. And you begin with this quote from the Stravinsky brothers, two great Soviet sci-fi writers, where Martin and I couldn't help but notice the dilemma of the Gramsci interregnum. Doomed, doomed, and wretched, or rather, happy and doomed, since they don't know they're doomed. They are relics, condemned to destruction by objective laws, which we understood as the Soviet Union's inevitable doom after the fall of the Berlin Wall. But it wasn't exactly clear where this journey would take us, which is precisely how the West and the East have ended up in Gramsci's interregnum. The old does not want to die and the new is not born. Tell us, how did you come across Gramsci?
So that quotation from Strugatsky's was kind of directly pointing to kind of the situation in which the Soviet Ukrainians found themselves right now. So they're basically raised by what many people, also in Ukraine, but also in the West, they perceived as a kind of like progress, as the progress of democracy or the progress of nation building. And some of the Ukrainians who actively participate in this, but that quotation in full, it points also to that there is a different idea of progress, and the progress which was brought by a social revolution, which actually created the Soviet Ukrainians for the kind of like a part of the. But of our people for whom the nation building processes and also the process of social revolution were tightly connected with each other. They were becoming Ukrainians in the same process as they were becoming the modern citizens of the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
And so So that different idea of progress connected to the social revolution, connected to a radically different vision of the world and the direction in which it's supposed to, or it can develop. And so that quotation is kind of like quite pessimistic. And the book which it comes from, The Snail on the Slope, which is one of the least understood books by Strugatsky's, although Boris Strugatsky actually called it the most important book for themselves. But it's indeed kind of like complicated with kind of not simple plot. It's kind of like a novel within a novel and so on. But the idea is that even defending the possibility of a different direction of progress may seem hopeless now, may seem kind of in a certain way reactive, not proactive, because it doesn't offer a different forward-looking project. But even such defense objectively has progressive outcomes. It's still important. It's still important to keep in this ground, keeping the idea of an alternative. Which may help to at least to preserve the space and prepare the ground for a new counter-hegemonic project, for a new social revolution that may emerge. But nowadays, yeah, it is indeed a certain Gramscian interregnum where the old has died, the new has not yet born, and this is an important perspective on the whole post-Soviet experience. The typical ways to discuss what started after the Soviet collapse was the first answer was, is it a democratization? And basically, this was Fukuyama's agenda. So even if Fukuyama might be wrong, so the liberal democracy has not triumphed yet, but it will triumph eventually. So that's even with all the obstacles, even with all the problems, that's the supposed to be the main road for development, not only of the post-Soviet space, but of the whole world, at least, like, ultimately, in the final instance. Many people started to doubt it quite soon, in fact, and there was an alternative viewpoint developed about the post-Soviet countries. Could it be that it's not about democratization, but about consolidations of regimes like Putin? So could it be that the post-Soviet condition is actually development towards stronger autocracies, stronger dictatorships? Putin, Lukashenko.
But that's the funny thread I was picking up. Yes.
Central Asian dictators, Aliyev in Azerbaijan. Mm-hmm. Or... and in this perspective, the country like Ukraine would become like a deficient autocracy, where different presidents try to consolidate power, but because of the our Maidan revolutions, they failed. And there are also other perspectives. Where perhaps it's not anymore anything unifying about the whole post-Soviet space, and the countries like Estonia, the EU member since 2000s, and Tajikistan on the other side, are became so different that it's just ridiculous to speak about them as a part of the same region. Or they might have had something in the past, but not anymore. And what we're experiencing is, in fact, kind of like a decolonization, the idea which became very popular since 2022 as a reaction to the Russian invasion, that it's ultimately the disintegration of the remnants of the Russian Empire on this huge territory, which is supposed to finally happen and may even involve the disintegration of the Russian Federation. At least in the hopes of some people. And I think that all of these stories are like kind of like they haven't come on the teleological narrative. So basically, this development to some goal, either democracy or autocracy or disintegration. But in fact, we might still be in the period of the crisis, when nothing is yet decided. No of those trajectories has won yet. No stable structure has emerged. And even the war between Russia and Ukraine could be understood as a culmination of this crisis. But the war may actually launch a dynamics that may eventually create the conditions for overcoming the organic crisis of the interregnum and create conditions for a new hegemony and a new counter-hegemony and maybe even for a new social revolution of a different kind that might also start or may at least get roots on the territory of the former.
Interesting that you mentioned Estonia. Estonia is really an interesting case because they embrace digitalization in a way like none of these other like former Soviet republics. I was invited like in 2012 to Estonia. I was really fascinated by the intelligence of the administrators to get into like digital education, stuff like that. Really, really interesting. It was like it was even like a vanguard process compared to what's happening in Germany. But you mentioned in passing Benedict Anderson's...
Well, if I may add, Ukraine is also kind of like making a brand of digitalization, and that was one of the selling points of Zelensky's government, that we are going to have a state in a smartphone, and that application in Ukrainian is called Dia, and in English can be translated as action. And it's also kind of like an abbreviation for the state and me, Tershava и я. It's been also in particular funded by the USAID and then promoted as a success story for other countries to take this experience. And in fact, many of the state services became digitalized, and in comparison to Germany, Ukraine may be even more digitalized, and which was actually like a big contrast from relocated to Germany from Ukraine.
You mentioned in passing Benedict Anderson's concept of the imagined community, which is that the nation state, even if it masquerades as a venerable entity, is a relatively modern concept that essentially goes back to an educational effort which, as he tells us, is deeply rooted in the printing press. This is where Ukraine, which voted for independence in 1991, has its problems. On the one hand, there was the decline legacy of the Habsburg Empire, while on the other, there was the Soviet modernization project. But when freedom comes, the comprador bourgeoisie, assisted by neoliberal economic advisors, come and rob what is to be robbed, resulting in the country's fall into the hands of the oligarchs as wild venture capitalism spreads. By the way, this isn't only the fate of Ukraine, but of almost all former Soviet Union countries. And as a result, there's this crisis of hegemony everywhere. Before we get to that, tell us about the crisis Ukraine was plunged into with its attempt to become a modern nation state.
Well, I would even say that it's not only the crisis of Ukraine, or it's not even the Soviet crisis. We are experiencing a global crisis of hegemony on multiple levels, starting from the crisis of the United States hegemony, and we see how it's less and less capable to keep stability and to prevent wars in many parts of the world. We now see the multiplication of the hotspots where the United States, even when they would like to prevent the war, they are not always capable to do this. And crisis of the rule of the contemporary transnational capitalist class, which some people address as a crisis of legitimacy. I think Habermas was speaking about the legitimacy crisis since the 1970s. The crisis of democracy, the crisis of political representation. There's a great book by Peter Mayer, Ruling the Void, Crouch's book, Post-Democracy. There's like expanding field of study in the nature of contemporary political crisis, and actually many people indeed perceive it as an escalating crisis, and that's why we see the rise of the populism of the anti-establishment parties. They try to reach to that groups of the voters which are feeling unrepresented by the legacy parties. What we experienced in the post-Soviet societies, I see it as a part of the global process. But because of the Soviet legacy, it could be experienced in a quantitatively deeper way. And so the post-Soviet crisis could have an extraordinary depth. And one of the reasons is that actually comes from the great achievements of the Soviet Social Revolution in the modernization of the Soviet society, in the organization and the political organization of the society, but which then degenerated and ultimately collapsed in the end of the 80s, in the beginning of the 90s. And what we've gotten that you mentioned, ruling class of, I actually call political capitalists, fallen Branko Milanovic and Ivan Seleni. The post-Soviet ruling class did not even have a legacy of any kind of traditional or religious or ideological legitimacy when they were grabbing the fragmented parts of the former state property that used to be in the ownership of the Soviet state or officially in the ownership of the whole Soviet people. But then they were very rapidly appropriated. And so we could have lived through the period of primitive accumulation, but unlike in the Western Europe, where that period could last for centuries, in the post-Soviet case, it could last for months. So there was obviously no legitimacy in the eyes of the post-Soviet people in how those property, how those factories, how those wealth created by huge suffering, blood, labor of the Soviet people were rapidly appropriated by the nouveau riche. And so obviously... So that post-Soviet ruling class by default didn't have any legitimacy and any pretense to be leaders of the whole nation. So not simply ruling and grabbing political power in order to fulfill their own interests. So that was a difference in perception, or in the depths of the hegemony crisis, the difference between the Western Europe and post-Soviet space. And the collapse of the communist hegemonic apparatus of the party and all of the social organizations linked to the party, which either collapsed or degenerated and became largely irrelevant, the trade unions, the various organizations for the other social groups, the quite developed Soviet press, which became less and less relevant, typically. Of course, there were some exceptions. The degeneration and collapse of that apparatus, that it created a huge void in the society on the political and on the social level, where the gap between the political and the social, between the social groups' interests and their political representation was especially high. And that void had to be, in many cases, filled from basically from zero. And it still looks like we are not in the end of that process. It's the question of constructing the ideological parties from zeros, and that's why the parties which actually try to appeal to any kind of articulated ideology have been so weak in general, or the notoriously weak, or it would be more proper to say narrow organized civil society in post-Soviet countries. Well, like in case of Ukraine, according to practically every public opinion survey, 80% of Ukrainian citizens have not been a member of any kind of a civic or political organization. And there is a civil society, and it actually might have and actually had some significant influence on politics, but it involves only a very narrow group of people. And that means that when they are capable to push some policies, it might not necessarily reflect the interests of the majority or even of any broader groups that might involve subaltern classes. So that's a problem of how this crisis of hegemony has been reproduced throughout all these 30 years and maybe even reproducing even now.
Sure. So when you're discussing the Maiden Revolutions of 2004 and 14, you repeatedly mention how the sense of resentment drove it, which I think is a bit what you're talking about, and how people couldn't couldn't articulate those interests. It's like a diagnosis of an emotional and not a political economy that was the driving force, which Martin and I most accurately think explains why the oligarch Petro Poroshenko, who snatched up the Soviet chocolate factories, was followed by Volodymyr Zelensky, the television celebrity, whose plans were rather cloudy. So when discussing Ukrainian nation building, you speak of the great disappointment in the years of stagnation, which leads to the historical paradox. Could it be said the war of aggression launched by Putin contributed more than anything else to Ukraine's nation building?
Well, it's true that actually quite many intellectuals believe in this. And they would say that we need to thank Vladimir Putin for getting a new consolidated Ukrainian nation. The problem is that it's actually questionable. Has Ukrainian nation building actually succeeded, at least from the perspective of the 1990s, right? So if you look at the map, Ukraine had in the 1990s, so that's those notorious borders of 1991, for which Ukraine is now fighting for in the war with Russia. We would see that Ukraine lost territories. Ukraine lost many people, millions of them, in Crimea, in Donbass. And since 2022, it might be possible that Ukraine lost the big parts of Zaporozhye, Lugansk, Kherson Oblast, Lugansk as well. So since 2022, Ukraine lost also millions of refugees. And at least right now, there are more and more pessimism about the expectations of those people who left Ukraine that they are going to come back to Ukraine. Because doesn't look that...
I do know people personally who won't come back.
There are also attempts to measure those wounds systematically, so just read one of the stories that it showed that nowadays it's less and less people who even claim that they would like to return to Ukraine. And the claims in the stories may quite often contradict the actual behavior. So it would depend on how the war is going to end. And the more the Ukrainian refugees with their children, and these are predominantly women, would be rooted in the EU, they would find jobs and their kids would be for many years in the European schools. It's more likely that their husbands, when they would be allowed to leave Ukraine, would rather join them in the EU instead of their families coming back to Ukraine into quite likely destroyed country with not great economic perspectives. But of course, it's really difficult to forecast this because it fundamentally depends on the outcomes of the war. So the point is that we might lose even more millions as refugees. And then it's actually a question, what for? For construction of very specific nation-building project that, I just started to talk about it, that basically erases the idea of alternative development of Ukraine, erases the part of the Soviet period in which Ukraine had great achievements besides all the horrors that also happened during the Soviet period. But also the participation in the universal movement for the human emancipation, the contribution to the struggles in the in many parts of the world, in Vietnam, in Cuba, in Africa, where Ukrainians were part of the people who helped the revolutions in other parts of the world, in the participation in the great modernization projects, in the industrialization, in the exploration of space, in the cybernetics, that's all going to be physically destroyed, partially as an outcome of the war, but also a huge part of that legacy has been destroyed during the post-Soviet years. And also ideologically erased as not part of Ukraine anymore, as the occupation and colonization of Russia during the Soviet period. Also, that's a hugely contested topic, and it's obviously not the way how many Ukrainians still perceive the Soviet period. And so, is it really a successful nation building then? So instead of incorporating that period and those people into the new nation building project for Ukraine, rather erasing them rather than pushing them away. So that's a question. And the Maidan revolutions, they actually contributed to the very contradictory development. And in fact, the reproduction of the post-Soviet crisis, which is our argument with my colleague, Oleg Shuravlev, where the Maidan revolutions were quite different from the social revolutions. And this is also a big part of the current discussions in the field of the studies of revolutions. Why exactly the contemporary revolutions are not revolutionary, in fact. And they they are not fundamentally transforming the class and state structures, according to the classical definition by Sidas Kaczpal, but they are failing even as political revolutions in establishing consolidated liberal democracies. That's the outcome of a very rigor systematic study, with very sophisticated statistical analysis methods by American political scientist Mark Basinger and his 2022 book, The Revolutionary City. The only tangible outcome of the contemporary revolution is that they expand the political space for the middle class civil society. But that middle class civil society, at least in the countries like Ukraine, has very specific interests, which in many cases are not exactly corresponding to the interests of the majority. And so the outcome is that the revolutions amplify the capacity of the narrow group of people to have an impact on the politics amplifies their interests, amplifies their agendas, which are not necessarily representing the majority of the society. And in this way, the crisis of political representation, the crisis of hegemony, is only reproduced or may even escalate. And now even during the war, well, we do indeed see in the surveys that, Ukrainians are consolidated against Russia. That's probably is true, although there are many questions to which extent the wartime surveys could be reliable. At least they are definitely less reliable than before the war. But is it a positive consolidation around some forward-looking project, that's around the project for Ukraine's development? Or is it simply a negative coalition against the enemy? That's a question about basically every question that might be asked in the service, for example, even EU and NATO. Well, we might have now like 70-80% of majority for integrating Ukraine into EU and NATO, even like leaving the question to which extent it's even possible. And it would be indeed interesting to watch this interview in a few years and assess whether Ukraine has been at least making significant progress towards Western integration, or it would be still in that gray zone area. But still, it might be possible that for many Ukrainians, EU and NATO is not exactly the positive project, but simply a pragmatic choice against Russia. And so far as the Western aid is so unstable and uncertain, the moods in Ukraine might go back into the typical divisions we've had for the whole post-Soviet period, and which I'm actually discussing in the book, in terms of the dynamics of attitudes towards NATO within Ukraine. So the question is whether it's indeed a nation building or simply a negative coalition against the conjunctural enemy. And it might be possible that Ukraine might still, even as an outcome of three revolutions in the life of just one generation, even after the bloodiest war since, at least on the European continent since the Second World War, we might still be in the period of the crisis. And this is a horrible thing to think about. So that's, the typical discussion, speaking about the post-Soviet condition, about the social revolution, was what all of those suffering was for. Why we lost so many millions of people in the Gulag, in the terror, in Holodomor, during the Second World War, and what for? Communism didn't work. The Soviet Union collapsed, right? But at the same time, the Soviet project didn't work ultimately. But in the process of building an alternative society, there were indeed very tangible achievements that are still a very important legacy for the 30 years after the Soviet Union collapse. That's one of the examples is the Ukrainian energy infrastructure, which was built under the Soviet Union, built by Ukrainians, by the Soviet Ukrainians, and how difficult it is for Russia to destroy that energy infrastructure using like hundreds of rockets. And that's yes. An outcome of the Soviet Union. That's an outcome of our modernization. That's an outcome of the social revolution.
So great engineering.
Of great engineering and all of that. The institutions, the physical legacy, that objectified labor of the Soviet people, they are still there. That's to a large extent that it was not physically destroyed yet. And so there was something, there were multiple tangible achievements of the social revolution. But it's a big question. What are the tangible achievements of the post-Soviet period? What are the tangible achievements of Maidan Revolution? Maidan revolutions, would they be capable to survive for decades? And wouldn't it be the case that the great suffering, great victims, multiple hundreds of thousands of lives, if not millions, would be lost, and we don't know what for. If you would start to ask these questions, let's say 10 years after this moment, 20 years and so on.
But maybe this is very interesting. You're talking about this is the point you're always referring to. You're talking about the crisis of representation, which is also taking place in the West. That's the one argument you always, this very, very convincing argument, by the way. When I look, and we come back to the fall of the Berlin Wall to certainly be like as a cornerstone. When I look at the Soviet Union's collapse from a German perspective, I see, like you, a significant crisis of a hegemony, where this political elite emerged as a kind of mafia, using legal means to seize the state's institutions, hollowing them out by robbing them of the legitimacy. The name is like thieves in the law. It's where Caesarianism gains ground, that instability grows. And if you want to maintain your privileges, you either defend them by force, or to prevent the disintegration of the Russian multi-ethnic state, you take refuge in the construction of the enemies, in this case, Ukraine. There's something here that you hinted several times coming into play, namely how the Western international community itself has experienced this erosive hollowing out, going from 9/11 to Iraq, Afghanistan, to the financial crisis, to Brexit, to Trump, and the pandemic. If we say the former Soviet revolution has stumbled into a material state of war, then Western democracy has stumbled into post-democracy as a form of symbolic civil war. Would you agree with this? Could what's happened in Ukraine and Russia be understood as a magnifying lens, bringing more significant political dilemmas into focus that extend far beyond them? Crisis of representation?
That's absolutely right. That's what I totally believe in, and I try to argue this in the book. That Ukraine is indeed a magnifying lens to a number of globally relevant processes. So I've talked about the Maidan revolutions, but it's not in, only in the post-Soviet space, not only in Ukraine where these kind of revolutions are happening. They're happening in many other countries. In the Arab Spring, that's, for example, the mass protest movements in Latin America, there are many similarities to the movements developed in the Western Europe or in the United States at the same time, the Occupy Wall Street, Indignados in Spain. What is sometimes kind of like loosely analyzed is populism, both as a feature of the electoral politics and also the responses to the crisis of representations, like populist parties, populist movements. Maidan revolutions from a certain lens could be seen as populist revolutions, where exactly the crisis is deeper and they are capable to overthrow the government. And supposedly they get the opportunities for a radical change of the society. We came to power, right? But they are not capable to change almost anything. And after overthrowing one oligarch, Ukrainians select another oligarch, Petro Poroshenko. And when they are disappointed with another oligarch, they elect a person who has zero experience in politics, Volodymyr Zelensky, who apparently has got some authoritarian, let's say, proclivities, if I use this word properly, wordlessly, like. Yeah, so that's what might happen. Or speaking about those notorious oligarchs of the post-Soviet space, those who grabbed the property and then they were capable to influence the politics and the tight combination of business and politics. The discussion about political capitalism is happening now not only about post-Soviet countries and not only about China. Branko Milanovic, for example, puts China as basically as an ideal, typical case of political capitalism. But we are seeing now writings about political capitalism in the United States. Trump could be analyzed in the same way. Also using the concepts of Caesarism or Bonapartism, the construction of, let's say, patrimonial group that tries to corrupt the formal democratic institutions in order to stay in power and to, in particular, use it also for their own business interests. So that's another thing. And also then that notorious polarization of Ukrainian politics. In Ukraine, it was usually conceived as East against the West. Some people tried to count correlations of the regional voting with ethnical distributions or linguistic distributions, like Ukrainian speakers against Russian speakers. And there are indeed some correlations. But the problem of polarization in the contemporary politics is definitely not simply about Ukraine. We see the Brexit polarization in Britain. We see the escalating polarization in the United States during the elections, the Democratic states and against the Republican states. At least in 2024, there are more and more serious worries about a possible civil war in the United States. It might not necessarily happen, and very hopefully it might not happen. But we see that there are more and more people actually worry about this. So it becomes kind of like on the horizon of something possible. Ukraine actually might show some of the more universally present trends in contemporary politics, which in our case, because of the depth of the crisis in the post-Soviet condition, those trends develop further. And this also gives a certain superior epistemological point. We see the development of the trends toward the few steps ahead, and we might be capable from this epistemological point of view to analyze certain developments in other countries a bit better.